Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. In 1982, Frank Huguenard received a B.S. from Purdue University in computer science and subsequently spent decades in Silicon Valley as a product engineer. About 12 years ago, his life plummeted into devastation as he lost his job while his best friend and soulmate was losing her battle to cancer. In a quest to make sense of his grief and bewilderment, he set out on a spiritual journey to understand the nature of reality and why so many people on this planet are suffering. The end result of this search has been his desire to share with the world the knowledge that he has learned along the way. Frank is a filmmaker and has recently completed a trilogy of documentaries on science and spirituality, Beyond Me, Beyond Belief, and Beyond Reason, which we will explore today. Frank, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, and thank you for taking out a little time from a retreat that you're holding right now in North Carolina. Can you share a little bit about what the retreat is about?
Sure. I can get to a little bit more later during the interview, but this is a an advanced yoga seminar, but it's not what most people typically think of when they think of yoga, at least here in the West, which is mostly just asanas or postures. This is much more of a comprehensive, deeper yoga retreat that involves all kinds of different detoxification programs and different types of exercises most people wouldn't normally consider as yoga.
It's a nice vision you just created as a sort of culmination of your journey. So why don't we go back a little bit now and work our way up to where you are today? Frank, I think a lot of our listeners could relate to the feeling of, you know, trying to do what's right in life, going to school, working hard for years, and then suddenly watching one's life disintegrate and unravel beyond our control. Can you share some of what you felt 12 years ago?
I could try. I mean, it's been a long time, and I've gotten over a lot of the anguish and pain that I went through. I had been, for a few decades, mired in sort of mediocrity in Silicon Valley, working in a lot of startup companies, attempting to be creative and do something useful and meaningful. You know, Groucho Marx used to have this joke, I would never want to belong at a country club that would have me as a member. And I sort of used to have that attitude at the companies I was at. I would never want to be an employee at a company that would hire me. But I was sort of always chasing yesterday's technology tomorrow. And I'd squandered all this time trying to get into the right place at the right time where I can create this, you know, genius product, whatever that would be. And I finally found myself in that position through a variety of circumstances. And I got fired, and this was happening while my best friend was going through chemotherapy and surgery and radiation for breast cancer. So it was torture. It was, you know, I finally had gotten myself into a position in life where I thought things were coming together, and then it all just slipped through my fingers.
There you were, kind of falling off a cliff. I mean, at a point in life where, as you say, this is what everyone is working toward, and you've been, you know, diligent for years and doing hard work and being creative, and it fell apart. And so,
My life was an utter and complete train wreck, absolutely.
So in that moment, obviously, the grief, the shock, what did you do? What did you turn to at the time?
I had grown up in a home that was filled with physical, emotional, mental, and substance abuse. And I had vowed, never to repeat that experience, especially since I also had children and I didn't want them going through what I had gone through. And here I had found myself basically repeating the exact same patterns, and which was even further disillusioning with the whole experience that I was going through. And so, you know, I kind of did the sort of traditional grief counseling. I buried myself into the bottom of the bottle and chased a few women around. But the one saving grace that I did come up with was that I had been a competitive athlete, which was another sort of prong in my life that had fallen apart at the same time, which is an entirely different story. But still, it was just all facets of my life were just not working. But I had taken an interest in yoga, and so I had begun doing vinyasa, which is flow yoga, 3 days a week for about a year, and that really helped at least rejuvenate me physically. And as a consequence of that, I was subscribing to the Yoga Journal, and at some point about 10 years ago, I came across an article about the Art of Living Foundation, where they were talking about this new breathing technique that the Art of Living was promoting called the Sudarshan Kriya, which, you know, all the things that they were saying about in this article, that it helped relieve grief, that it helped reduce stress, that it reduces cortisol, the stress hormone, it helps you sleep better, it helps you become more creative. And certainly if you look at my life, what I've done in the last 10 years, that's all certainly true. So I started Art of Living, which is a comprehensive set of spiritual practices, including meditation, the posture type of asana yoga, Sudarshan Kriya, and a host of other practices, including becoming vegetarian.
Before you discovered this, and it's a great thing that you had that inclination to seek out the yoga and the breath work as well. Did you try in any part of traditional counseling? Was anyone wanting to prescribe things for you instead, in terms of traditional, you know, mainstream medicine and such? Did you ever have that kind of experience?
My friend who had passed away a few years before, maybe a year before she got sick, she had given me Alice Miller's book, The Drama of a Gifted Child, which, you know, I mean, I've dabbled in stuff for decades. I probably tried meditation off and on and looked at Monroe Institute and did different seminars along the way, but it was all very sporadic. But I would say Drama of the Gifted Child was one of the sort of pinnacle moments, you know, that sort of started me on this journey. That would have been in 97 and 98. And that book really resonated with me a lot. And I remember, and I read one or two books a year, cover to cover. I'm not that much of a reader. And that one I just plowed through over a weekend. Mm. And when I put the book down, you know, my inclination was to, you know, go to a psychologist right away, which was something that I'd been resisting for, you know, forever. You know, I called up another psychologist I know and asked her to recommend somebody. And she, you know, this guy that she sent me to was, you know, on the top of her list. And, you know, I feel basically like I wasted a lot of money and a lot of time going to him for a couple of years. It just didn't, you know, Western, you know, psychoanalytic theory just didn't do so much for me. You know, just to me, it didn't really make much sense. And I don't have, I'm not a big fan of Western medicine or psychology, so I'm not going to do that. And I certainly would never have put any chemicals into my body.
Well, it's interesting. For listeners, the Drama of the Gifted Child explores what occurs when a child is not properly mirrored by a parent or parents, and in a sense creates a kind of mask that pleases or tries to please the parent for approval, but then gets kind of in the way of the authentic self coming forward.
Right, and the gift that she's talking about, and I'm an extremely gifted person, but that's not the gift that she's talking about. The gift is basically the coping mechanism that we build, you know, to help us get through things.
The sort of Western mainstream way of approaching grief and healing didn't really fulfill you so much, so then you went toward your search for the yoga. Can you share, please, then, what came out of that and what began to transpire in your journey?
You know, I basically at this point in my life, is like I said, 10 years ago, around 2003, I had tried different techniques and programs, and I was basically just ready to, you know, almost go in with blind faith and devote myself. It's just, okay, let me just see. Sort of a very scientific, this is kind of how I do things in life, anything. Once I get into something, it's, you know, I'm sort of all in. So for a few years, you know, I just went along with the practices and, you know, I'd continued living you know, the lifestyle that I'd been living. I mean, Art of Living and probably most of these other organizations, Transcendental Meditation and Vipassana Yoga and all these, they don't really impose a lifestyle on you. It's more or less you begin meditating and, you know, slowly but surely the traits and tendencies that got you into the pattern of behavior that you're in slowly slip away. I like to say that I quit drinking 100 times, but I only stopped drinking just once. If you understand the difference. I mean, yes. when I stopped drinking, it just was a happening. There was no decision. I mean, when you quit doing something, there's a part of you that always wants to continue on, and there's part of you that says, no, you have to stop this. Whereas when I just stopped, it just happened, and I look back, oh, look, I'm not drinking anymore. So it's much more organic and natural way to drop the traits and tendencies that are causing suffering in your life.
Yes, as opposed to that internal battle going on, it sounds as though that was just lifted.
Right, that internal conflict was ultimately lifted and gone.
Can you share a little bit of the story of how meditation then helped you turn your life around?
Well, this question, I hear this question and I address it so much somewhat paradoxically, because I think in the West, I think people want to see some sort of evidence that in a materialistic way, you're living a happy life and you own a big ranch and you've got horses and, you know, you're taking trips to Hawaii every year or whatever. And my life's not like that. You know, certainly I'm a lot happier than I was.
My life's not like that either.
Well, right. Well, but you want
we just dug ourselves out of 30 inches of snow here in Maine.
Right. So you want to be able to go out and say to people in the West, look at the results in some sort of tangible, concrete way where they say, wow, look at this. Look at what this guy's done. And yeah, I want some of what she had, kind of thing. And so you know, if you don't know me, you don't get that. If you would have seen me 10 years ago and you were then to look at me today, you would sign up for the Art of Living course this afternoon. You'd be like, wow, this is amazing. And I know that my mother passed away this last August, and I've got 6 brothers and a sister, and we all congregated in California. And of course, we all grew up in the same very dysfunctional, the mental health in our family was not very good. And it spawned a whole bunch of other kids with poor mental health. And it was then when I was juxtaposed against all my family members, where I can really see the stark comparison of them versus me. And realizing, wow, how am I so lucky that I was able to break free from this? Because, you know, they had all been stuck in these patterns. And if you're not doing any maintenance at all, you just become crustier and crustier. All that stuff accumulates and gets thicker and thicker, and they struggle through life. So, you know, it was one of those moments where I can say, wow, this has just been such a huge difference for me in my life.
You know, what you just said, I've used the term amplified. You know, what things we struggle with in life in a family can become amplified over the years in different individuals. And, you know, what you share, I understand what you mean about looking for results. But, you know, there are many people who in the same situation would have gone down that involutional spiral and basically died from drinking. They're in all our families. It does occur. But you found something to hang on to that helped you to, if not turn around, at least pull out and start to move forward. A kind of a, you know, almost death and resurrection image comes to mind. And that's very valuable. That's valuable to a lot of people. You know, so I really commend you for the example.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I still have, you know, a lot of anger that I've got, you know, that I don't understand, that I've, you know, I've got decades of repressed anger that's been churned by decades of suppressed memories, neither of which that I have, you know, any idea of what it's about or how, you know, how can you let go of something you don't know that you're holding on to. But, you know, I've got a couple kids, and when I look at where they're at now, sorry, I'm getting a little choked up, you know, compared to, you know, where they were 10 years ago, it's really quite a miracle. And it's all I need to do to be grateful, to see where they're at. So it's really been quite amazing, and really no complaints. It's been amazing.
Well, you know, maybe you can start work on a fourth film called Beyond Anger. And I think a lot of people might want to watch that. So let's turn now to some of your film work. When did you begin to make films along this journey? When did that come to you?
After 4 years of Art of Living, this would have been around 2007, I went through a summer of a lot of heartache, another relationship. You know, I mean, when you grow up in a mentally unhealthy family, you always attract these other people who are mentally unhealthy, and then you go through the same patterns and behavior. But through the summer of 2007, I basically had learned how to meditate, or sort of got it, if that means anything. And I began to have these experiences where I was, it's very difficult to explain or describe what meditation is about for those who haven't, you know, undertaken it. You know, how do you explain to someone who doesn't know the meaning of the word sugar, what sweet is? But I was having these meditations that were 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours long of what I could only describe as pure divine love. I mean, just incredible. And the first thing you want to do is you want to go around and shake people. It's like, do you have any idea what you're missing? I mean, this is amazing. So I quickly set out and started writing a book, a manuscript called Beyond Me, off and on for about 3 years. Ultimately, in the fall of 2010, someone asked me, "Well, why do you want to publish a book?" And I thought to myself, and the answer, you know, simultaneously was A, I want to help people, and B, well, I'll just do a documentary film. That's kind of how I roll. You know, I just go off and do things. And turns out that doing a documentary film has a lot in common with writing software. So I was able to parlay a lot of my engineering skills and. You know, really,
That's interesting what you just said. I like that. Yeah. You found there were a lot of commonalities.
Well, you know, in software, you have building blocks, and you build up. And in fact, if you look at Beyond Me, the subject of the film is a lot about software and how, you know, our body's the hardware and our consciousness is the software and the operating system and the applications. But when you write software or do films or whatever, you've got building blocks you build up, and you've got, you know, command lines and routines and subroutines, and you build them up into bigger and bigger programs, and that's what the film turned out to be. I actually thought I was finished in just 3 weeks, amazingly enough, but then I started having focus groups and getting feedback. But start to finish, it took 8 weeks, and to this day, it's been released, you know, over 2 years now, and to this day, I get emails from around the world telling me how much of a life-changing film it is. So it's been very gratifying.
Okay, so it's great to make films, and because you're still a creative person, and it's another way to communicate and to reach out and to help process things, actually, that you're thinking about. Can you share a little bit of what Beyond Me tells? What is the story?
Actually, most people wouldn't recognize this unless I told them up front, because the film stands great on its own. But I had taken, you know, my friend who had passed away from breast cancer was the basically second. She was not my wife. She was the next relationship afterwards. And then, like I said, I had another relationship that ended in the late 2000s. And a lot of the premise for the film came out of me looking at these relationships that I'd gotten into and examining the patterns and the cycles that two people get into over and over and over again, and why do we attract these archetypes back into our life. And so if you look at the film from that perspective, it makes it a little bit more interesting. But what I do in Beyond Me is I draw a link between the migration pattern of monarch butterflies and personality disorders. And basically explain that most of the behavior that you see in people exhibited is not, you know, certainly there's some portion of it has to do with your environment growing up, with your mother and father. But we in the West put far too much emphasis on that. And really, a great deal of our personalities comes from hundreds and hundreds of previous births that we've lived through reincarnation. And the solution to the removing these impressions or these instinctive behaviors that we have in our lives, like drinking or gambling or whatever relationship issues that we have, all get removed by doing meditation.
And do the monarch butterflies, you know, symbolize then the cocoon, the rebirth? How do you connect the ideas of the monarch butterflies to this?
To me, I went out looking in nature for the most phenomenal example of animal instinctive behavior. And there's certainly a lot of it. All you have to do is turn on the Nature Channel and you'll see some, you know, salmon spawning or whatever, bears hibernating. But in monarch butterflies, you have a generation is born in Mexico on a very small mountain range, a relatively small mountain range. And they begin to migrate northwards. And after five or six generations of flying, maybe north to Texas, and then Oklahoma, and then Missouri, and then Indiana, and then Michigan, and then Canada, after so many generations in over a summertime, they get all the way up to Canada. And then the seventh generation eats enough food to make the 2,500-mile trip all the way back to the exact same mountain range in Mexico where their great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were born. And of course, Western science likes to wave their hands and say, well, this is just a mystery of nature, and we don't really know how this is done. It's in their DNA, which of course is utterly ridiculous to think that something the size of a leaf can carry with it over seven generations, you know, enough GPS information to get back to this, you know, small mountain range. Mm. But when you take into account ancient wisdom from the Vedas, it makes complete sense. In fact, if you look at my film in the context of Darwinianism, I've sort of filled in a huge missing link in between Darwinianism and intelligent design, where all of a sudden everything kind of falls into place, and you can say, "Oh, well, this is how evolution works. Evolution is not about, you know, random mutations and survival of the fittest. You know, there's an intelligence behind how these traits and tendencies that all the different life forms on this planet have get propagated forward generation after generation."
Would you say that this is something of a spiritual nature and not just a building block in DNA?
Absolutely. Although, you know, if you look at everything from the context of everything is consciousness and the material world is just a manifestation of that, then DNA actually is a manifest property of the spirit. So it really blurs the line in between spirit and nature when you look at it from that angle.
That's a very helpful addition to the science and religion debate, what you just shared. Who has seen it? What has been the reaction to this film?
So far, I don't know how to differentiate it right offhand. All my films have been viewed about 500,000 times. So probably Beyond Me has been watched over, let's say, 200,000 times. It's going to be a broadcast on Australia in Perth on March 9th on broadcast TV. So that's kind of a cool first for me. It's been shown in theaters in India and other places. You know, it's really meant for everybody to inspire and motivate people to start meditating and look at different things in their lives. Certainly, I get a very common reaction from both fundamentalist religious people as well as scientists. It's amazing the similarities between their positions against the film. The words are a little bit different, but if you took the words away, you really couldn't tell if you were talking to a scientist or a right-wing, religious person. If you just look on the testimonial page on my website, which, by the way, happens to be beyondmefilm.com, you can see some of the comments that I've got. My favorite's always been this one. It is said that the truth, with a capital T, cannot be said, ... but you did it.
Now, let's touch base on your second film, which is called Beyond Belief, and that's a documentary that questions the official narrative, as it were, of the Bible and attempts to recontextualize the teachings of Jesus as someone who may have trained and died in India. Why don't you share a little about what motivated you to head in that direction?
Right. So I did a film 2 years ago, and I thought, you know, in the first month it'd be watched 1 million times. You know, I was a little bit foolish in that with my expectations. I've heard, over the years, countless times that Beyond Me is superior to I Am, What the Bleep Do We Know, The Secret, all these types of films. And all those films have been watched tens of millions of times. And this one's, you know, mine's got all this wisdom, but at the same time, it's also very practical, you know. So I thought I was finished, but then it didn't really go viral, and I was like, well, you know, what the heck? Why not? And reincarnation is a central theme to Beyond Me, and I had grappled with, well, should I, you know, leave it in or take it out? But you know, if I had taken it out, it really would have taken apart the glue that holds the whole film together. I really couldn't have done that. So then I started to think, well, you know, why is reincarnation such, you know, such a hard thing for Westerners to get their mind around? Why, you know, Jesus certainly would have taught reincarnation. He was an enlightened master. What happened there? You know, why did that not, why was the relevance lost there? So I started digging into, and I was just going to do a film about that specifically, you know, the lost teachings of reincarnation by Jesus. There's some mention of reincarnation in something called the Gospel of Thomas, which is something I'd heard about a long time ago and never really, you know, I never really looked at. I'd been raised Catholic and kind of threw out the baby with the bathwater when I was 20 years old and never really looked back.
We talk about that a lot on this program.
Sure.
And so it's interesting to return then to something, you know, from your childhood, your initial impressions, and to start to, you know, unify or bring together some of these different aspects that have been informing your spiritual life.
Exactly.
Now, the Gospel of Thomas, of course, was one of the Gospels that was edited out, as it were, or not included in the New Testament. So why don't you share a little about that?
Like I said, I prefer to use the word censored. But I had, you know, Googled, and anybody can Google Gospel of Thomas. It's you know, an hour, 2 hour read. It's 114 sayings, or not really parables. They're almost too short to be parables. But they're very short sentences. You can read through this, plow through it in an hour or two. And when I read through it, you know, in some of it's very esoteric and confusing. You know, if you look at it in the context of Christian, you know, Western contemporary Christianity, it just doesn't make any sense. And in fact, if you look at Beyond Belief, I sort of manufactured this debate between me and this Yale professor as he's trying to interpret some of these passages, and he can't make heads or tails out of them. And then you've got Frank, who's sitting there on a log or whatever, saying, "Well, here's what I think it means," and let the viewer decide for themselves. Okay, which version makes more sense? In any event, when I first looked at Gospel of Thomas, I understood it, you know, top to bottom almost immediately. And it was all the exact same teachings that I had been studying for the last many, many years through Art of Living and through other, you know, outlets of Eastern philosophy. And I was like, oh, my God, this is, you know, this is pure Eastern Vedanta. And so then I started digging deeper, and I came across, you know, all these different legends. I had always heard rumors that he had studied in India, but again, it didn't have any meaning to me because there was no context for me to say, oh, what is Indian? You know, I had grown up kind of brainwashed with this polytheistic, you know, description of Hindus and that they're heathens and all this stuff. And I really, because of that, sort of didn't really look. But now that I had been there and done that and understood what, you know, the underpinnings of Hinduism really are, you know, I can look at this look at these stories of Jesus traveling in India with a much more open mind. And then a big part of that journey of looking through this research is that there's a lot of credible evidence and compelling evidence that after the crucifixion, Jesus went back to Kashmir and lived there until he was a very old man.
There have been many books out there trying to capture the essential Jesus, the historical Jesus, the missing years of Jesus. You know, in the Bible, he's 13 years old in the temple, and then he sort of reappears much later, kind of 30 years old.
He reappears as an enlightened master by making tables and chairs for 17 years.
Right, right. Yeah. So, of course, there's been a lot of speculation that, you know, he in fact did travel east and, you know, had his interaction with the Essenes. And then, as you say, you know, there's the question, did he go further than that and bring back teachings about life and what's been called eternal life, perhaps, which was sort of negotiated terminology away from the reincarnation idea. So now, did you find information that was able to support your theory?
Sure. It's not even my theory. It's just what I put forward. And in fact, you know, what I really try to do in the film Beyond Belief is really play the role of a prosecutor or a defense attorney and just sort of spill out the case and basically say at the end of the film, you know, try to forget everything you've ever heard on either side of the fence of the story of Jesus and watch the film and then say, okay, which version do you believe?
This is Kara Hallenbeck, and you're listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to religious tolerance and spiritually based living. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation with filmmaker Frank Huguenard. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You're live with CARE, and we're speaking with filmmaker Frank Huguenard about his trilogy of spiritual documentaries, Beyond Me, Beyond Belief, and Beyond Reason. Now, Frank, for listeners who just may have joined us, before the break we were speaking about the second film in your trilogy, Beyond Belief, which focuses on the premise that Jesus may have lived and died in India. Let's focus now on your suggestion that he basically lived a long life, lived to an old age and died there. Can you elaborate?
Sure. And by the way, my film Beyond Belief has a lot of the anecdotal and historical evidence that's common in other books and documentaries. And that's on, if you just go to beyondmefilm.com on the Beyond Belief page. And on that page, there's another almost half dozen, I think, documentaries that I've got linked there. So, you know, you can do your own research and look at all the different evidence and draw your own conclusions. Beyond Belief really focuses predominantly on, and it takes up the heart of the film, on the, I mean, to me, this is the most obvious approach. If you're going to say that Jesus learned, you know, some of his spiritual practices in India, then the argument should be based on, you know, some of the spirituality in the Bible and not in the Bible, and some of the apocryphal texts. So a big heart of the film is looking at Gospel of Thomas and comparing it to Vedanta and other Indian philosophies. But there's a, you know, there's a tomb in Srinagar, Kashmir, that's purported to be the tomb of Jesus, and there's evidence supporting that. There's documents, there's ancient scriptures in India called Puranas that mention Jesus coming there and the king. When Jesus was 85 years old, you know, the king was encouraging him to get a wife because he was getting advanced in age and needed someone to take care of him. So they're supporting, you know, Indian documentation. There's temples and other artifacts in India with his name and sayings, and the kind of sayings that you can readily identify as the things that Jesus would have said carved into temple walls in India. And so, you know, there's a lot of evidence to support that he had gone there. So it's all in the film, and like I said, it's all in the other films as well that are linked on my page.
And that's quite a different narrative than from the, you know, young man who died at 33 in the Middle East.
But right, let me talk about that a second. There's a lot of interesting artifacts in the Bible itself about that day, Easter Day, so many years ago, that really make you scratch your head. Usually with crucifixion, it takes up to 6 or 7 days for someone to die on the cross. And the reason that you die on a cross, this is something I learned along the way, is from suffocation. At some point, you get to the point where you're just so weak that you can't support yourself anymore, and you just can't breathe, and you can't get enough oxygen. And to accelerate that, sometimes, if the person doesn't die quickly enough, they're going to break his legs, and so he can't support himself. And we know from the Bible that they didn't do that. Furthermore, they do this on the Friday, the night before the Sabbath, which would have been a huge slap in the face to the entire Jewish nation for the Romans to have done this and leave, even if this guy was a heretic and a criminal, you just wouldn't do that on the Sabbath. So that's something that's very peculiar. They had this sponge filled with vinegar and gall that they lifted to his lips and his mouth and his nose. And this would have had the effect of smelling salts. It would have sort of woken him up. And in fact, it had the complete opposite effect. When they lifted this up to his lips, he passed out. And then there's, you know, at least one more suspicious something that happened that day is Joseph of Arimathea brought in 100 pounds of healing herbs into the tomb, aloe vera and other stuff. So why would you bring in healing herbs, you know, to a tomb of somebody that was dead? All that said, to me, the jury's still out. I don't really know, and I don't really care too much. You know, the message of the resurrection is don't fear death. There's nothing to fear. You are not your body. Whatever you are that is not your body persists and continues on after you drop your human frame. That's the message.
Yes, and that's what I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, after centuries of people exploring and debating and not knowing and different accounts and all that, and now you bring your own experience and accounts into things, what is the significance? What's the meaning piece to you? Did he die on a cross here, or did he live to, you know, old age there? What is the meaning piece in it for you along your journey?
Well, the meaning to me of now going back and reading the temple, I mean, the Sermon on the Mount, or these other things in the Bible, to me, it only reinforces what I've learned over these last 10 years with Art of Living. And my next film, which we'll talk about in a bit, is all about Vedanta and what that is. And so now going back and reading the Bible and these passages and looking at the life and times of Jesus really just reinforces what I've gained over the last 10 years. But a big part of what Vedanta really teaches is experiential. Now, you can read all the books that you want on all these topics, but like I like to say in my third film, Beyond Reason, if you want to learn how to swim, at some point you're going to have to get into the water, and that's really what I've done over the last 10 years. And when you do that and you experience these deep states of love and bliss and peace in meditation, and then you read the Bible or the Quran or the Torah or Vedanta, they have much deeper meaning. So to me, that's what I get out of the life and times of Jesus.
Now, your latest film, Beyond Reason, pertains to the area of science and spirituality. And in it, you basically use the scientific method itself to put science under the microscope. What did you see?
You know, again, it's always sort of looking backwards. It's almost like I'm living my life backwards, and each film goes and tries to make the previous one go viral and so forth. But it's where have I struggled in the past of providing enough compelling evidence to sway people, and where has there been resistance? And a big part of that, especially here in the West, has been modern science. And if you understand language and thought and ideas and concepts and how they propagate over centuries in schools and institutions, and see how ideas are passed down from one generation to the next, you can really start to look at the birth of modern science 400 years ago and how it really changed, you know, the culture here in the West. As science itself became more and more materialistic, Western culture itself also became materialistic. And the further away we got from our roots in a much more organic way of looking at the physical world and the metaphysical world combined. And so I really wanted to portray that and look at the history of science and see how ideas spawned and were sort of built on top of one another to the point where we are today.
Yes, of course, the division of spiritual from material, yes, that is where a lot of my modern science came from and came out of. And we've been sort of seeing the pendulum, I think, swing one way to an extreme that leaves people wondering about meaning, that leaves people wondering about what healing actually is, and it starts to come back a little more to center, bringing back people's spiritual values into the arena, into the healing or medical arena, bit by bit. I think that's an important direction that we're heading in.
It's very difficult, though. I mean, I talk to academicians, and they're so stuck on, you know, when I talk to these people, like I said, it's almost like talking to, you know, someone who's very religious. They're so stuck in their dogmas of how things are. They can't begin to incorporate something like reincarnation into any laboratory, and any self-respecting scientist would never really talk about reincarnation, otherwise he would lose his reputation and his credentials. You know, reincarnation is something that could never, ever possibly be proven in a laboratory. And so what modern science does is just ignore it. And yet at the same time, evolution can never possibly be proven in a laboratory. And they can never prove Darwin's theory of random mutations in natural selection either. But they have no problem believing in that, including it in their dogma. So it's a little bit of hypocrisy they live in, really not allowing themselves to include consciousness into any of their equations. You know, consciousness to most modern scientists is a byproduct of brain function, and they leave it at that.
I want to allow for the exceptions out there, because we've encountered them over the years here on the program as well. Recently, we had an interview with Anthony Stern, MD, who wrote a book on Mother Teresa and the power of prayer as a psychiatrist, I guess, incorporating a little different approach in his work. And, you know, it's interesting to me when we learn about Darwin and what set him off on his journey. He started off as a member of the Church of England, I believe, mm-hmm. and then his son died and sent him into sort of a crisis of grief, crisis of faith. And it's interesting that was sort of the dividing point as he went off on his journey, which was actually kind of a journey of grief, going around and looking at nature and writing things down. And, you know, and out of that comes so much of what we employ today. It's just fascinating to me how grief or how mourning affects the human being. But it's also important for me to also keep a human face on this, that whether we're talking about the churches or whether we're talking about the scientists or the doctors, that it's still a very human story. And folks like, you know, at Emory College, there's a program called the Tibet Emory Program, where the Dalai Lama sends his monks to come learn about Western science, and they have a great exchange, and I guess wound up, you know, teaching each other some
right,
things.
That ended up on my cutting room floor. Beyond reason, got a little bit too long. I had something about that in there.
But, you know, what I'm saying is I try to take people one at a time, is what I'm saying, rather than talk to them as entire groups.
Right. And what I'm trying to portray here is it's not the scientists themselves so much as you look at how Western culture is educated, and in that we're scientifically minded. And so certainly there's exceptions to the rules, but our entire education system, and mostly in the universities, the mainstream, you know, is stuck so much in a dogma. And a dogma, by definition, is a really tightly held belief system that people are really reluctant to let go of. And so most people in society who wouldn't even consider themselves scientists still have this, you know, fabric of thought that they've sort of been endowed with, that's been handed down from the scientific community. So that was sort of my point on that.
Can you share some now about the ancient Indian branch of wisdom that you've mentioned already a couple of times, Vedanta, as its own legitimate form of science? Can you share some about that and what you discovered?
Sure. So most people are familiar with the word Veda. Vedas are scriptures that are, no one knows how old they are. They may be hundreds of thousands of years old, which goes against modern science, but who knows? They've been handed down forever, and there's something like 18,000 books. They're so huge that no one person can actually go through them all in a single lifetime. And Ayurveda, for example, means life sciences. So the word Veda parallels the word science very much. It means both a body of knowledge as well as a way of acquiring it. Anta is a Sanskrit word for it means the conclusion over the end of. So putting the two together, Vedanta is the end of knowing, or the end of knowledge. And so Vedanta is a part of Vedas, including Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita and a few other commentaries that really represents the highest knowledge in Eastern or Indian philosophy, and at the same time, it also provides a means of attaining it. It's a very practical body of work. And Vedanta in this country, there's the Vedanta Society, there's Vipassana, which is dhamma.org. TM in this country promotes and teaches Vedanta, and like I said, Art of Living does too. The one that I could personally recommend is the one that I've experienced directly, which is Art of Living. So that's what the one that I would prefer. But really, they're all out there for people to explore and to immerse themselves in, if that's something they're interested in doing. But Vedanta, let me continue for a second here. Vedanta does everything that science does. Science gives you a sort of framework for analyzing and discovering the truth or the falseness of a theory. They give you axioms and definitions, assumptions, protocols, postulates, hypotheses, and methods and techniques to have you go out and experiment and run experiments and duplicate experiments that others have done to verify the results. And similarly, Vedanta does exactly the same thing. It gives you a set of definitions. Some might be you are not your body, or the truth is that which doesn't change. Anything that changes isn't real. And then it gives you a set of methods and techniques to, for you to go out and personally verify if these are true or if they're not true.
And is this a form also of medicinal knowledge for oneself? And how would that be applied then? Is it more on an energetic level?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because I just did a process, you know, in the yoga retreat that I'm on right now, that it was a very much a healing process. You know, we went through the body doing what in the West we might consider isometric exercises, but it was all combined with some other chanting and some other energetic body work that's supposed to be very healing in nature. So absolutely, that's a big component of it. Ayurveda, which is a bit separate, would also include herbs and other, you know, treatments to deal with mostly balancing out the body energies. They look at all illnesses as imbalances in your different body types, and so they heal you by trying to provide balance rather than trying to treat the individual symptoms like we do here in the West.
Now, I know you've got to head back into your retreat shortly, Frank, so I just want to ask you briefly, how do you think the journey through your films can help others? How do they pertain to life-changing awareness as you have experienced?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because it makes me want to repeat something I've been telling a lot of people. The third film, Beyond Reason, you know, what I've heard from people is that the second time they watch it, it's almost as if they're watching a new film. It's so deep, but it's so thick. You know, it's a little bit dry because it's an academic film. There's this Vedantic expression, sometimes we need to use a thorn to remove a thorn. Meaning sometimes to get beyond our intellect, we need to use our intellect to get there. So it's a little bit dry, but if you watch it twice, you're going to get much more meaning out of it. As far as how life-changing it is for a lot of people, I know thousands of people have begun meditating just by having been inspired by watching my films. Other people have, like I said, gotten involved with TM or Vipassana or Art of Living, and that certainly is very gratifying that so many people have looked at this work. One thing from Beyond Belief, which is very gratifying, is I've heard from countless sort of ex-Christians or recovering Catholics or people who have grown up with some sort of indoctrination that just didn't make sense to them. And they felt guilty and felt incomplete by leaving, you know, like I said, throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But then I was communicating with a nun this week who was so grateful. She had gone into to a monastery and become a nun for many years, and she left disillusioned. And then when she went back and watched Beyond Belief, she just felt so much better that, you know, that she wasn't delusional. She wasn't crazy like everybody was calling her. And a lot of people who have watched Beyond Belief have gotten back into Christianity, but much more of from a holistic approach and viewpoint. So it's really changed a lot of people. As a body of work, the three films together is quite large, and there's a little bit of something for everybody in watching them all.
That's very powerful. Thank you so much for the story about the Catholic nun. That I always like to put flesh on the bones of spiritual stories. Yeah. And that's great. Frank, as we come to the end of the interview, I just want to let listeners know that all of your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com, and there people can follow you and support your work as well. I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It's been a pleasure, and I wish you the best of luck with your films and with the rest of your retreat.
Thanks so much. I'm beginning work. Beyond Anger may be there, but my next work, I think, is going to be Beyond Thought. And I do all this out of my own pocket. I began this with no experience or training or expertise or money or help. I did them all myself. And so if you enjoy my films, you know, there's a donate button on my page. Pass me a few bucks and kick it in so I can do more films. That would be great. And thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you again, Frank. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to info@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.